Thank you very much, Alan. I'd like to speak today on two topics. First, I'm going to provide a summary of some new payments research from the Reserve Bank. And second, I'm going to give you a brief update on progress on the new payments platform, which this is an industry initiative to put in place some new payments infrastructure that will spur innovation in the Australian payment system. So let me start with the bank's new research. In 2007 and 2010, the bank conducted some detailed diary surveys of consumer uses of payment. And today the bank is releasing the results from its third such study, which was conducted in late 2013. The research discussion paper is written by my colleagues Christos Linsky, who's here today, Ty Lam and David Emery, and it'll be available later this morning on the bank's website. I'm going to summarise some of their findings for you. The bank contracted a research firm to conduct a survey with three elements: a pre-diary questionnaire about the demographic characteristics of the respondents, a seven-day payments diary, and a questionnaire about respondents' payments preferences and attitudes. The response rate was very good, with a final sample of over 1,150 respondents that were representative of the Australian population in a wide range of aspects. And for the first time, the survey was completed by most respondents online rather than on paper. The diary provides details of all payments and transfers made by respondents over a seven-day period. This includes details of the amount, the payment channel and payment method, and the type of merchant. It's a very rich database with detailed information on over 15,500 payments that will allow us to look at a range of research questions. Not surprisingly, the survey shows us that cash is used most often for small transactions. For example, it's used in nearly 80% of transactions of $10 or less. This is not surprising, as cash has many advantages in terms of convenience for both consumers and merchants. But then as transaction size increases, the use of debit cards initially increases most, then credit cards, then electronic payments such as BPAY or internet banking, and finally then cheques. And I imagine that most people looking at the results of the study can relate to this ordering of payments. The latest survey indicates that many of the trends we observed in the 2010 study have continued. Looking at the share of the number of transactions, there's been a continuing decline in what we've traditionally called the paper-based payments methods. While cash remained the most frequently used payment method, it was used in about 47% of all transactions, but its relative importance has fallen significantly since 2010. Cheque use has also continued to fall. And these trends have been mirrored by an increase in various forms of electronic payments, with a significant increase in the use of cards, and also an increase, albeit from a small base, in the use of PayPal. Looking across age groups, cash is used more by older individuals than younger ones. But the decline in its share of all transactions is evident across respondents in all age groups. The decline is also fairly broad-based across different types of merchants. Now, it can be partly explained by the fact that the mix of transactions in the economy is changing. It's gradually shifting from in-person to online, where cash is not used. However, the decline of cash is mostly a function of the decline in its use in the traditional point-of-sale environment and the development of electronic payment methods that can match or surpass the convenience and speed of cash in some types of transactions and transfers. So while the survey confirms that the rate at which cash changes hands is falling, there are actually few signs that holdings of cash are declining. We know from the aggregate data that banknotes on issue have for a long time grown broadly in line with nominal growth in the economy. So that's the sort of the currency to GDP ratio has remained fairly steady. And the survey suggests that the amount of cash in respondents' wallets actually grew between 2010 to 2013. So together, this evidence suggests that cash continues to have a significant role both as a store of value and for precautionary use when other payment methods are not available. The flip side to the declining use of cash has obviously been the rise in the use of cards for transactions of all sizes. This has been associated with continuing growth in the number of card terminals in Australia, which are up by about 35% over the past 6 years. And it also reflects advances in card technologies and authentication methods. The ongoing shift to the use of PIN in card transactions and the sharp pickup in the use of contactless payments have both resulted in a reduction in the typical time needed to complete a card transaction. In the latest survey, 2/3 of respondents reported that they had a card with contactless functionality, and almost half of these reported a contactless transaction in the week of the study. Contactless transactions accounted for about 22% of all face-to-face card transactions, and the share of contactless was significantly higher for payments under $20. The use of contactless was higher for those respondents that reported that speed of transaction was an important factor in choosing which payment to use. The survey also shows that contactless was used more frequently at retailers such as supermarkets, petrol stations, takeaway food stores, where the speed of the payment is likely to be important for either the cardholder or the retailer. The survey provides some evidence that contactless card payments have been displacing both cash and signature or PIN authorised card transactions. However, on balance, based on a post-survey question, it seems that the greater effect has probably been for contactless to displace traditional card transactions rather than cash. The survey also shows that there are significant differences in the use of debit and credit cards across demographic groups. Younger households are much more likely to use debit cards than credit cards, presumably reflecting reduced access to credit cards and a preference to use their own money. Lower-income households also use debit more frequently than credit, most likely for similar reasons. However, those in the highest income quartile, so that's on the right side of the panel here, use their credit cards significantly more often than their debit cards. This may well reflect a greater desire to get reward points associated with credit card use. The survey shows us that an individual that's in the highest income quartile is 6 times more likely to have a premium credit card than a household in the lowest income quartile. Not surprisingly, the survey shows a significant decline in the use of cheques. Around 80% of respondents reported that they had not written a cheque over the previous year. Cheque use is, not surprisingly, especially low in younger age groups. However, it's also declining significantly in older age groups. And we can expect the decline in the use of cheques to continue as other payment methods become available to meet either the needs of households that currently still prefer to use cheques or the needs of businesses that currently find there are few alternatives for some specific uses. This is something the industry is working on, and the delivery of the new payments platform, which I'll speak about shortly, will provide an opportunity to continue this process. The survey also provides some evidence on the growth of some relatively new methods of making payments or transfers. For example, it shows that PayPal was used for around 3% of transactions in 2013, which is up from around 1% in 2010. This reflects both an increase in the share of transactions occurring online and an increase in PayPal's share of that segment. Smartphone payments are obviously an area of strong innovation in the payment system. The survey shows that there's a shift towards making more person-to-person transfers using smartphones, with around 9% of transfers to family and friends now made by a smartphone. However, the use of smartphones for payments was still low, at less than 1% of consumer payments to businesses. So it appears that, at least for the time being, smartphones are mostly a convenient alternative method of internet access rather than a means of payment in their own right. But this clearly has the potential to change as new NFC or Bluetooth technologies for point-of-sale payments emerge. Finally, the survey provides some evidence on the effects of some policy reforms implemented by the bank over the past decade. One such reform was to the ATM system in 2009. One of the intents here was to provide greater transparency in ATM fees. It's supposed to be blank, by the way. greater transparency in ATM fees and to allow ATM owners to better recover their costs. This relates to fees paid on transactions at ATMs not owned by the individual own institution, so-called foreign transactions. For cardholders, the main change here was not in terms of the level of the fees paid in on transaction, but on the transparency of those fees. So in particular, if there is a fee, the individual must now be notified prior to authorising the transaction, rather than in their subsequently monthly statement. And the reforms appear to have had a significant impact, with the latest survey showing that only 15% of ATM withdrawals incurred a fee, down from 23% in 2010. So a small change in the transparency of a fee has apparently had a significant effect on consumer behaviour. The survey also provides some evidence on the bank's reforms that required card schemes to remove their no surcharging rules in 2003. This was followed in 2013 by a change to allow the schemes to limit surcharges to the reasonable cost of card acceptance. And this change was intended to find a reasonable balance between the scheme's desire to prevent excessive surcharging and merchants' rights to recover reasonable costs. Now, we know from other surveys that a significant fraction of merchants impose a surcharge on card transactions from one or more of the card schemes. And where merchants levy a surcharge, they're more likely to surcharge more expensive payment methods, and the typical surcharge is higher for more expensive payment methods. However, the current survey showed that only 4% of card transactions attracted a surcharge, indicating that consumers have proven to be pretty good at switching away from surcharge methods of payments. In addition, the survey provides evidence that consumers who are willing to pay surcharges are more likely to place a value on rewards programs than those who do not pay surcharges. The bank has signalled in its submission to the Financial System Inquiry that the Payment System Board will be continuing to study the issue of surcharging, and especially the incidence of apparent excessive surcharging. However, it's important to remember that some payment methods, for example, credit and charge cards that provide the cardholder with significant rewards, can be very expensive for merchants. Accordingly, it is important, subject, of course, to appropriate disclosure, and also that there is at least one payment method that is not surcharged, that merchants should be allowed to surcharge for more expensive methods. This is, of course, not just an issue for some high-cost cards. We may find, for example, that it becomes more relevant for cash, and especially for cheques, as their use falls and their costs increase. Now, related to this, I should note that the consumer use survey is not the only work the bank has been doing to improve our collective understanding of the payments landscape. In particular, the bank is currently undertaking a large-scale review of the costs borne by financial institutions and merchants in accepting different forms of payment. We last did an exercise like this in 2007. This year's exercise involves a wide range of entities, including a number who are attending today, and is examining the costs of a number of different payment methods. It will also involve a survey of small and medium-sized merchants so that we understand how the costs borne by smaller merchants differ from those borne by larger ones. We've benefited from consultation with financial institutions, merchants, and associations, and we'll be continuing to work closely with these entities until we publish the report towards the end of this year. Moving on, I'd now like to give you an update on progress with the industry's new payments platform project. It's almost exactly 2 years since the bank released the conclusions of its strategic review of innovation in the payment system. In the review, the Payment System Board identified a number of gaps in the services currently provided by the payment system. Among these were the ability for individuals to make electronic payments with real-time funds availability to the recipient, the ability to make and receive these payments outside of normal banking hours, the ability to address payments in a relatively simple way, such as to a mobile phone number or an email address, rather than a BSB or account number. And most relevant for businesses, there was the gap in the ability to send anything more than a minimal amount of information with an electronic payment. Accordingly, the PSB set a number of strategic objectives to deal with these gaps. And in response, the payments industry has come together to work on a project that aims to meet these objectives. It's working on a project known as the New Payments Platform, or NPP, which will establish a completely new set of infrastructure. As recommended by the PSB, the industry's NPP solution will be based on a hub-based infrastructure. That is, financial institutions will all connect to a central set of shared infrastructure. This will be more efficient and access-friendly than the bilateral links that characterise much of our existing payments infrastructure. For example, a new entrant will only have to make a single connection rather than establishing bilateral links with all the existing players. It will also be more innovation-friendly in that there will be a central body, an industry-run utility company, that will be able to coordinate upgrades to the infrastructure. Together, the payments hub, or the switch, the communications network, and the central addressing service that is being built will be known as the basic infrastructure. This infrastructure will link financial institutions such as banks, credit unions and building society, as well as other approved entities. It will allow the exchange of fast, flexible, data-rich payment messages. It will be available to support new types of payment services that can be tailored to the particular needs of customers, including ones that we have not yet thought of. It will be linked to a settlement service built by the Reserve Bank, which will provide real-time interbank settlement of each NPP payment. And all of this new infrastructure will be available on a close to 24/7 basis. While many types of services will be enabled by the NPP, the first will be developed cooperatively by the industry. It's currently been called the Initial Convenience Service and is expected to focus on real-time, person-to-person payments using mobile channels. While some banks currently provide services like this, they effectively only provide real-time payments if the two parties are customers of the same bank. The NPP project is being overseen by a steering committee that includes representatives from a wide range of institutions, both large and small, as well as the Reserve Bank and APCA, the Australian Payments Clearing Association. The committee is working to implement the NPP by the end of 2016, which is consistent with the targets set in the strategic review. And the current focus of the committee is on the selection of vendors to provide the basic infrastructure and the initial convenience service. It's expected that the successful vendor or vendors for the basic infrastructure will be announced in August. There is currently also a lot of work underway to establish the utility company that will own and govern the basic infrastructure. The Payment System Board has been keenly watching the progress of the NPP. The board expects that the NPP will create a good platform for future innovation. It's been particularly encouraged by the way that the industry has come together to work on the NPP. It's conscious of the substantial commitment of time and resources that the industry is making in this project in response to the strategic objectives identified by the bank. This investment will deliver significant benefits for the Australian economy. It should also help to ensure that the institutions that are currently providing payment services to Australians remain relevant in the future too. The centralised infrastructure and real-time nature of the system, combined with the flexibility of payment messaging, ability to capture additional remittance information, and the easy addressing capability, will mean that payments can be better integrated with many other aspects of our lives. Businesses should be able to achieve substantial efficiency gains, and there will be significant improvements to the timeliness, accessibility, and usability of the payment system for consumers. If it's implemented effectively, the NPP will place the Australian payments infrastructure at the global frontier. All in all, it's a very exciting time to be in the Australian payments industry. Thank you.
Hi, it's Sean Drummond from the Financial Review. I think in the UK, they're sort of pretty much ending cheques in 2018 or something. Is there any plans to do something like that here in Australia?
This is something the industry's been working on, led by APCA. And the industry is working on ways to reduce the use of cheques to ensure that there are good alternatives for the current users of cheques. What we know is that at the moment, checks are still used in the business sector in some specific areas such as superannuation and real estate transactions. And there's work underway to reduce that reliance already. We expect that the new payments platform will provide some provide new payment instruments that may well further reduce reduce the use of checks. So it's likely that we will see a continuing decline in the use of checks and that they will be phased out at some point in the future, but that there are no immediate plans by the industry to do that. One factor here is that checks are becoming an increasingly expensive means of payment, given that that infrastructure spending is being allocated to it to a decreasing volume of checks. So checks are becoming very expensive, and we can expect financial institutions to probably begin charging more for them accordingly.
Maybe a question from me, Tony. So in terms of the two components of your presentation there, you dealt with the payment study first and then the real-time payments topic second. In terms of consumer priorities that you uncovered in the diary, where do you think speed of transaction sits in terms of the other priorities of convenience, security, etc.?
We did ask questions such as that. I think the answer was that there were a wide range of attributes that people valued, and it's very hard to say what the dominant attribute is. I think that tells you that consumers are looking for different things in different payment instruments, and that we can expect a range of payment instruments to continue to meet their different needs. At the moment, for the time being, certainly cash is valued by users for a number of attributes. People like it for its ease of use. They like it to help with budgeting, that they're not spending money that they don't have. And cards are clearly very useful for many purposes, electronic transactions also. So there's a wide range of attributes that are valued by consumers, and that's why we see a wide range of payment instruments out there.
John Kavanagh from Banking Day. Both Visa and MasterCard have complained that the powers that you've given them to limit excessive surcharging don't work, and then they're not able to do it. And they and a number of others have argued that some regulator needs to monitor and police that part of the system. Do you accept that the measures you've put in place haven't worked and need to be fixed?
What the bank has done is enable the schemes to put in place to cap surcharges to the reasonable cost of card acceptance. They have put, to varying extents, attempted to implement those. I think it's too soon to say that they haven't been successful. We haven't necessarily seen the full effect of their implementations to that. What the survey shows us is that a relatively small proportion of card transactions are actually surcharged, and the transactions. What we see is that merchants that do surcharge are those that tend to have higher payment costs. We see that when they surcharge, they're more likely to surcharge a more expensive payment instrument, and they're also more likely to surcharge more expensive payment instruments at higher rates. So in many ways, the surcharging regime is, the surcharging framework is working as we would expect. Now, I'm not going to defend the surcharging practices of all merchants. I think we can all point to a few industries or merchants where surcharges look on the high side. The schemes have got some procedures in place, and it'll be important to see if they're able to implement those. The PSB has said that it will continue to be looking at this area to see if further action by ourselves, ACCC or ASIC are needed. What we need to ensure is that surcharges are very transparent. And also that there is also
a non-surcharged means of payment available to consumers at all times.
Sorry, just following on from that. Obviously, yeah, the card companies have called for some other regulator to be involved, apart from yourself, in enforcing those guidelines. Can you already do that yourself, or does it can you do it in coordination with the ACCC or ASIC to actually enforce them as a regulator?
At the moment, I think it's up to the schemes that providing surcharges meet the various requirements of Australian consumer law, that consumers consumers have got the right to go to a different provider if they don't like the surcharge or use a different means of payment. But this is something that I imagine will be considered in the Financial System Inquiry, and as we've said, the Payment System Board is continuing to look at it. The schemes have the schemes were quite effective at policing no surcharging rules, so I suspect that that they could be more effective at policing a reasonable cost of card acceptance cap. If they were to implement this rigorously.
A little bit lighter note, Tony. You spoke about the hub and enabling innovation in the future, etc. Is there any consideration for alternative things like Bitcoin and things like that, and how they would be settled? Is any of that sort of stuff on the horizon or on the agenda?
Bitcoin gets a lot of coverage in the media, but it's very much a bit player at the moment when it comes to use as an actual payment instrument. I'm not aware of any industry-wide initiatives on Bitcoin, and I'd be surprised if there were any underway